Welcome to the Leadership Window Podcast with Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and professional speaker. And now, here's Patrick.
Thank you, Rosie. I love saying that. Thank you, Rosie. Rosie's not real. She's our artificially intelligent announcer. And her name is Rosie. So that's what I call her. Welcome to episode 5 already of the Leadership Window Podcast. Thanks for joining along. Today we have an amazing guest. I will tell you, someone who is inspiring me, raising my game. Forrest Alton is our guest today. Forrest is the co-founder and president of a nonprofit consulting firm called 1000 Feathers. And we'll get him to tell us what the heck that name means. But Forrest has spent more than 20 years in the nonprofit and social service sectors in a variety of capacities. So we share that in common. We've both moved from leadership practitioners in the nonprofit sector to a role where we're helping nonprofit leaders lift their capability and strategy and leadership thought, et cetera. After a decade of service in C-suite roles of a number of organizations, particularly one highly successful nonprofit organization that we'll get him to tell us about, Forrest stepped down to focus his energy on the launch and operations of 1000 Feathers and made this transition because he saw a need to improve the social service sector and strategically advance work in underserved communities in particular. So again, something we really share in common. Our viewpoints, I think, of the sector led us to say we might be able to actually serve the sector from a different seat, from a different angle. But he's committed his life's work and the work of 1000 Feathers to training and developing leaders, helping organizations think and act more strategically, posing those difficult questions that organizations are afraid to ask themselves, and encouraging the big, bold, just courageous conversations at all levels of the organization and throughout communities. I could go on. He's a dynamic, very dynamic, inspirational leader, very charismatic, very influential in his work. And he's just developed this contagious energy for helping others. And his energy has been contagious to me and inspired me to do a lot of what I'm doing right now. Forrest has a master's of public health from the University of South Carolina's Arnold School of Public Health. So that's his educational background. He's received just a ton of accolades and awards, but the public health bent sort of gives you a little bit of the feel for where he ended up moving in his nonprofit work. But he's been recognized by the state newspaper here in South Carolina as one of South Carolina's top 20 under 40 emerging leaders, and also by the Free Times as one of the 50 most influential people in Columbia, South Carolina. And he's no longer in Columbia, South Carolina as of this year. He's in Memphis, Tennessee. So we'll get him to tell us about that too. Forrest, I could spend the rest of the episode just going through your accomplishments, but we won't do that. Let's just hear from you. Welcome to the show.
Patrick, thanks for having me. On one hand, it's sort of embarrassing to sit here and listen to it. On the other hand, I wonder if you're free to travel with me here for a little while. I can use that introduction. My goodness, thank you.
Well, you should listen to it back and go, wow, you know, I've done some stuff. Like, I'm somebody here. Who knew?
It's now, nice to be reminded of that.
Yeah, somebody's got to tell you. And you know, right. You certainly have to tell yourself from time to time. Anyway, man, it's a thrill to have you on the show. And I, when I launched this program, you know, you initially start thinking of who do I want on, and it, super quick list came together, and you were on that super quick list. Like, yeah, this is a podcast about leadership, and with through a social sector lens. So who better, right? So again, thanks. I really appreciate you carving out time for it.
Happy to do it. I'm glad to be one of the early guests, and more importantly, glad to be one of your early subscribers. I think this is going to be a great journey.
The show's amazing. I mean, our first episodes have just been tremendous. I'm just like, oh my Lord, why didn't I do this a long time ago? This is so right. great. And you know, and I've said, I'll probably do a solo episode here and there, but it'll be a couple of months or so because I've got enough people. The show is better with people like you. My idea is, you know, let's get people smarter than me to do more of the talking, and that'll make the podcast great. And then every once in a while, I'll want to opine on something and, you know, sort of buffer some of the time. But anyway, glad you're here. And I do, obviously we're going to talk about a lot of things, but let's start with your move to Memphis. Those people listening to the program that are our followers here in South Carolina, where I'm based, of course, they know you as the South Carolina guy. You graduated USC. You ran the South Carolina campaign to prevent teen pregnancy, which is now called Fact Forward. And then you launched 1000 Feathers right here in South Carolina and in Columbia, KC to be exact. And then you moved to Memphis. What's this move about? And just tell us about that transition real quick.
Yeah, good place to start. You know, I moved to South Carolina in 1997. My initial entree in the state, I finished my undergrad degree at Coastal Carolina, which is in Conway. And then shortly after that, moved to Georgetown, South Carolina, spent almost 3 years there working in after school and youth development programs, and then spent the next 18, 19 years in Columbia. So, you know, in South Carolina, 23, 24 years, give or take, basically my entire adult life. And just very recently here in the last, you know, 2 or 3 months, my wife and I have relocated to Memphis, Tennessee. Heather Brandt, my wife, who is very clearly my better half, that's a non-disputable fact to anybody that knows us.
The blonde scientist, as she's known.
The blonde scientist on Twitter, that's exactly right, has taken a senior position at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And you know, as it turns out, when St. Jude calls, those are the types of opportunities you don't turn down. And for somebody like my wife that is a researcher and has an interest in cancer prevention, you know, St. Jude is an amazing opportunity. So here we are in Memphis. You know, we've talked about this before, Patrick, and I've sort of threatened that I could do this consulting gig from anywhere as long as I had good Wi-Fi and an airport, right? And I feel a little bit like this move is the world calling my bluff on that. but interestingly enough, having relocated in the midst of a global pandemic, which I don't recommend, by the way, as it turns out, all I really need is Wi-Fi. I haven't even needed the airport just yet.
Well, that's awesome. And by the way, we're going to want Heather on the show as soon as we can work that out too, because she's, I mean, talk about a leadership challenge and the chops it takes to even get invited to fill a role that she's now filling at St. Jude is just amazing. We won't take time on that story, but I'm going to want her on the program as well to talk about leadership from her point of view. It's a unique set of challenges what she's doing. So thanks for talking about that. Tell us about 1000 Feathers. I know that's the first thing people listen to. 1000 Feathers. What the heck kind of name is that? Where'd it come from? What's it got to do with nonprofit consulting?
Yeah. So just a touch about the name, since I just talked a little bit about Heather, I'll focus on the feathers part first. The feathers part of our name is one part forest, one part Heather. You mash those together and that's how you end up with Feather. Of course, my good friends and colleagues love to give me the proverbial, elbow in the ribs and, you know, say, dude, you only got one letter. The deal. But it's a pretty fair distribution.
Well, feathers just sounds better than Horace.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And So that's the feathers part. The 1,000 part actually comes from an area of the country, the area of the country where I was born and raised, the Thousand Islands in upstate New York, on the St. Lawrence River, actually right around where Lake Ontario meets the St. Lawrence River, is an area of the country known as the Thousand Islands. It's one of the most beautiful places in the country, if I may so say myself. I'd put it up against almost anywhere between like June and September. The rest of the year, it's covered in snow and there's really no reason to be there, which, you know, quite frankly, is how I ended up in South Carolina in 1997. But the Thousand Islands is still very near and dear to my heart. Heather and I spend as much time there as we can. You mash all that together and you end up with 1,000 feathers.
1,000 feathers. So okay.
That's a little bit about the name.
All right. So tell us about the company.
Yeah. So I would describe it as an ongoing evolution, right, of thought here. We are just now barely 4 years old. So still relatively new in this journey. You know, the tagline of the company is vision, strategy, results. And it's pretty intentional. And I think in the very early days, my thought was that a lot of our focus would be on connecting vision and strategy, right? And you and I have some shared experiences in the sector. So you'll be familiar when I say that I was seeing groups or individual leaders who excelled at one of those or the other. They were visionaries and could predict the future, but had no idea how to get things done. Or they were such good executors and so in the weeds, they couldn't think five steps ahead. And we thought, what would it look like to put together, you know, a consulting firm, for lack of a better word, that was connecting vision and strategy, helping people excel at both of those things. You know, a lot of that work has continued to look like strategic planning. I mean, I wince at that word, as I know you do, but I don't have a better one right now, and people know what we mean when I say strategic planning, although... Yeah. I will tell you that I had sort of nightmares when I was entering the consulting space of, you know, driving around with flip charts in my trunk, facilitating Saturday afternoon board retreats. And I thought, I hope that's not all that consulting is, right? With no disrespect to my friends that do really good work in that space. And you and I do work in
and
that
we
space,
still do carry flip charts in our trunk and do Saturday.
Do,
yeah,
we
still
do. But I really wanted it to be different than the Saturday afternoon retreat, right? And I couldn't get my head around what that looked like. And most recently, I've really settled on the word transformation. And I think where we really excel as a firm is in an organizational transformation space. That is not just helping people think about or change what they do, but really changing the way they think and they behave and they act. And for us, that looks like longer term engagements. It looks like, you know, spending 6, 9, 12, 18 months with clients in a real transformative type of space and environment. So yep. It's less about the creation of a thing for us and more about the transformation of how organizations conduct business, quite frankly.
Yeah. Obviously that all resonates with me. You and I completely share that lockstep in common. And I think there's more of us in this space that lean toward that now too, because organizations are, you know, they're tired of the stale, you know, the Saturday retreat being the end all. One of the things I say is that strategy is not an event. It's a continuum and it's a process. And we totally have that in common. I've got my own answer to this because you and I are not the only ones that have moved from practitioners in the sector to coaching or consulting and helping others in a different seat. And so we've all got a unique perspective and experience on this, but how would you define the difference in view from this side. You know, it's like, I don't know which side's the dark side, but you know, we were both CEOs of in the nonprofit world, doing all that challenging, you know, leading with a board and a staff and a mission and complexity and, you know, trying to be someone in our community so that we had some influence to get something done. Now we're in a really, really different role. How would you sum up the difference in the view? What have been your big ahas coming over to the consulting side of things?
Oh, wow. Really good question. There's a few things that pop into my mind right away, some of which are very personal to me, some of which are probably more general. On the personal side, I will say that probably 5 or 6 years ago, actually, I mentioned that the firm itself is 4 years old, but it was probably a few years before that, I started to get just a little bit of an itch, right? I started to realize it was time to be thinking about something else. And part of the real personal reasoning for me, at least in part, is if we were in the film industry or the movie industry, I was beginning to be typecast a little bit, right? You mentioned my time at the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy. Mm. And, you know, I was in my late 30s at the time, give or take. And I knew that I had a whole career journey in front of me. And I was really starting to get to this place where I was being typecast as the teen pregnancy prevention guy. And not that there's anything wrong with that. It's a field and an issue that I'm still incredibly passionate about. But I just knew there was more out there, right? And it was becoming less possible for me to sit at tables, either with organizations or in communities or otherwise, and have people see me as anything but the teen pregnancy prevention guy, right? So one thing that is really, really different for me, and I think it's important personally and selfishly, is that our firm has really become what I like to say is issue agnostic, right? So we still do some work in the adolescent health space, but we're also working in early childhood. We're working on youth development. We're working on public health issues. We're working on community transformation. We're, you know, working on all sorts of different things. So one thing that's fundamentally different about the view for me is the ability to jump back and forth between issues and not have to be locked in on a single issue or a single thing. I think that's really important. Another thing about the view that's different for me is the clarity that comes with having some distance, right? So we're not in an organization anymore every single day focused on a single thing or a single mission. We're back at 30,000 feet or maybe even 100,000 feet sometimes. And it's been striking to me the clarity of view that comes along with that when you're not sort of down in the weeds all the time. That has been really, really interesting to me to observe and process and subsequently figure out how to translate that into, you know, consultation, coaching, advice for our clients and partners. I think those two things come to mind right away. And then one other that I would offer that I will admit, you know, my personality struggled with early on and still struggles with a little bit, but I'm learning and continuing to get better, is that from this consultant seat, you are, by definition, making recommendations or suggestions. You're not necessarily making decisions, right? And sometimes it's complicated, again, for a personality like mine to put a lot of time, thought, and effort into something and make a recommendation and then have somebody not take that recommendation or not do anything with the report you wrote or not implement the strategic plan like you would have. But those things maybe aren't necessarily what you were hired for, right? That was really frustrating for me early on. And I'll admit a big change. I've spent so much of my journey in positions in organizations where I was expected to make decisions that backing up and making recommendations has been a big shift in my mentality.
I can completely relate to that one. And I'll tell you, my way around that is I became a coach instead of a consultant. it kind of takes me off the hook, but the reality is I say that all the time. I say consultants come, you know, like you just said, they're expected, they're paid to have some expertise in a subject matter and to make some recommendations and to, you know, do some analysis and bring some answers. And, when you are issue agnostic, it's hard to be an expert in everything, but leadership is leadership and strategy is strategy. So we know we have a point of view on that we can help people through. But yeah, I feel you. I mean, even as much as I, you know, rant on the whole, I'm a coach, not a consultant. The reality is I am expected to, and I do bring a perspective to the table. I have stories, I have experience, I have ideas and models, but they're mine and they don't work. You know, how I would lead might not be the best way for them. That's been the challenge for me, is to remember, hey, they have a different style than you. They have a set of challenges that you don't know the depths of, you know. Yeah. You know how, what you'd do if you went in there. And it's not necessarily the right thing. So that's a big pressure on both of us in that world, is that we do have to be careful about, we have a big responsibility to share ideas with organizations who are the ones tasked with actually doing it, pulling it off.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And also reminds me sort of another, you know, vertical, if you will, within our organization is the work that we're doing in communities, right? I would guess it's probably, I don't know, 60-40 maybe, in terms of whether our quote unquote client is an organization or is the community. And what I mean by that is it might be a foundation or a philanthropist or an organization hiring us to help them either with a community assessment or, you know, deeper community engagement or those sorts of things. I thought of that when you're thinking about it. It's not necessarily my thing, right? But it's an interesting pivot, recognizing, you know, are we being hired on this particular engagement to work with an organization, or are we being hired to go out and more deeply engage the community? That has been interesting for me as well, because I think we've assembled a team of folks that can sort of turn both directions, right? That can sit in boardrooms or sit in executive rooms and handle the organization side, but we can also then go beyond the street, be in community, doing community engagement. And that really then does become, quote unquote, our thing. And you can probably even hear in my voice, it's where we get a lot of energy, is the outward facing work as well. And I neglected to say that when I was introducing 1000 Feathers, but it is a big part of us. So, you know, again, whether it's working inside the organization or externally doing deeper community engagement on behalf of a client, those things produce different sorts of energy and different sorts of opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. And there's some threads already through a number of the things that you're already talking about. I think of the word results, the third word in your brand construct, which really is the transformation part, right? Is results. Something actually got better. Actually achieved something. Well, you know, I would say, and I'll brag about you for our listeners a little bit more. I think when you launched 1000 Feathers, you took off. At least you appeared to take off like a rocket. I mean, the business just instantly became a real thing here in South Carolina, one of the major players in helping nonprofits. And I think the reason, is my speculation, is you. The relationship and what people know about you and what they know about you is, in your role at the campaign, you produced results. Your organization produced results under your leadership. And so you have a track record. It's kind of one of John Maxwell's levels of leadership, that people follow you if you have a track record of success. It's like, this guy knows what he's doing. He knows how to, so people are calling you, many of them, at least early on, those, all those that knew you, you know, that were sort of easy to plug into early on. They knew you as someone who did this and did it well. And they're looking at it going, tell me how you did that. Tell me how can we do what you did? Because they want that success and they see it and it was visible. So I think that's a lot of where the consultant side really does come in, particularly for someone like you who has the background to say, I know a thing or two about running an organization and leading complex change with multitude of partners. So to me, that there's a thread, there's results that you want for your clients, but you have a track record for results, and leaders need that. People look at him and say, oh, he talks big, but what's he done? What's she done? You know, but you walk the walk.
I appreciate that. And I think that is something that we did lean into, especially early on. You know, Patrick, you will appreciate this distinction, but when I stepped down from my position as the CEO of the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Pregnancy, June of 2016. When I stepped down, my intent was, quote unquote, to do some consulting until I figured out what the next thing was.
A side hustle.
I knew it was time to transition, and I was just going to, again, quote, do some consulting until I figured out the next thing. It didn't take too long to realize there was some there, right? And that perhaps the next thing was, in fact, putting together a consulting firm. And, you know, as you alluded to, that was a very conscious decision that we made in late 2016 that we were going to go out and try to build a firm and a team of folks. And that still is, as I said very early on, a work in progress. We're still figuring out what that looks like and how do we engage thought leaders and not just have, you know, full-time staff, but also part-time folks and people we can call on and subcontractors and members of a sort of collaborative approach, if you will, that bring lots of different skills. But at the end of the day, you know, it is my face, my presence, my involvement on lots of different projects, right? We're not so big that there are projects we're doing that I'm not intimately involved with. And, you know, quite frankly, that becomes one of the challenges in going from being a consultant to trying to build a firm. And we've chatted about this before, but it's the, you know, the motivation to be able to sort of scale a little bit the work that you're doing, contrasted with the client who calls you after an engagement and says, but wait, we hired you. We didn't hire your team. Mm. And interestingly enough, you know, to go back to the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy example, you know, one of the reasons we were successful, if not the main reason we were successful, is because of our incredible team of people. There were just so many rock stars on that roster, many of whom are now out leading their own organizations, making big decisions themselves, and it's really amazing to watch. But I really grew because of the presence of strong team members. And I feel the very same way about this consulting piece, that I want to surround myself with the best in the business, right? That I'm not afraid to pick up the phone and call Patrick or call Charles Weathers or call whomever and say, hey, I'm struggling with this. Like, can you help me? Or can we partner on this? You know, I think people would probably hear that and be a little surprised. Like, hey, aren't these guys all competitors? Well, maybe. But more importantly, we all really deeply care about the sector and want to make ourselves better. And if I'm not good at something, I'm okay saying that. And so subsequently, when somebody says, hey, why didn't you come do this? Why'd you send us so-and-so? I quite often say, because they're better at the thing you asked for than I am. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
My responsibility is to get you the best person I can. And quite frankly, that's not always me. As soon as I learned that, not just at the organizations I ran, but also in this consulting gig, the better my life and my journey and my ability to achieve results became, when I realized that it wasn't all about me, right? And that's part of my leadership mantra, quite frankly.
Here's what's interesting. As you're talking, I'm thinking this. I'm thinking you had a place in your career where you were the high individual performer, and that shifted into a CEO role where you were now, you had to move from being high individual performer to high impact leader. And it was about getting performance out of others. And then you launched this consulting gig and you were back into high individual performer mode because you were by yourself pretty much. And now that you've formed a team, you're making that transition back to high impact leader again and having to lay down some of the high individual performers. So you're having to reemploy those leadership competencies that worked so well in your CEO role of a nonprofit, producing great results because you surrounded yourself with good people. You're finding yourself, I mean, I'm paraphrasing this for you. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it.
You're finding yourself back in that leadership role again.
I think there's some truth to that. I really do. And, you know, I maybe haven't articulated it even for myself as clearly as you just did, but I think you're exactly right.
Well, and the hard part of that I find in coaching so many leaders is delegation is often a tough thing for leaders. And the toughest part of delegation, I think, for leaders like you and me, I'll characterize you here for a minute. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the tough things about delegation for us is we're fine with delegating the things we're either not good at or don't enjoy, or just, it's just not our, we shouldn't be the one doing it. The difficulty comes in delegating the things that we are good at, the things that we do love doing, you know, so that we're actually creating opportunities for someone else to learn and get better and thrive and succeed. And that's, you know, I'm a little bit, I think, behind you on the team building piece. I'm structuring a little bit different. You know that we have an advisory board, so they're not consultants that I'm sending out, but they're people who just kind of help us think through our content and our strategy. And then I'm starting now to formulate a team. I've got a coaching associate and I've got a digital marketing manager. And so I'm headed there in the direction that you're moving, but it is difficult to let go and hand off to a team member something I know how I'm going to do it. I know it's going to be good. And I know how to do it and I know how I want it done. Those are the things that are hard to delegate. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, I do agree. I do agree. And, you know, it is, though, part of creating, you know, brand consistency, right? And I say that not just in terms of how your logo appears on a piece of paper, but what is the service delivery that people can come to expect when they hire your firm? Right?
And what a great thing to remind all the organizations that we serve. Because the same applies to them. They have a brand construct that's important. Habitat for Humanity. We'll take that one. We've both done some work with them. They've got a brand name to protect. So, and part of that is how they show up in, it's your brand experience. So if they, whoever they experience, whoever they engage or interact with related to Habitat, that's their brand experience. And so Habitat and everybody else has to make sure that they're developing the leadership chops across the board so that everybody delivers that high quality experience and in the same, not exactly the same, but in the same vein.
100%. And again, these are things, as you said, the sort of journey coming full circle here. These are things we really put forward during my time at the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy, right? And I won't get into naming names here because you forget people and then you get in trouble. But if I were to start listing out the roster of folks that was on our team 5, 6, 8 years ago, that are now running foundations, that are VPs at hospitals, that are CEOs of their own nonprofits, that are professors at universities.
Yeah. First round draft picks is what they are.
That's exactly right. And And there's a certain level of pride, right, for me, but also for the organization, that those folks' journey can be traced back to our time together at the South Carolina Campaign of Preventing Pregnancy. And I'm hopeful that you can at least at some level, start to replicate that with the consulting firm that we're building, that you'll be able to see some of the through lines as well. Like, wow, that organization really took off after they worked with 1,000 Feathers, or they really were able to do XYZ as a result of our partnership with them. And this sort of conversation all started with your recognition that word results is very specifically part of our tagline and brand, right? We didn't just stop at vision and strategy. Mm-hmm. And that was intentional for all of the reasons we're talking about.
No, I love it. I love it. I'm curious from your point of view. I love this conversation because, I've got my own experiences with this, but it is really helpful for me and gives me broader perspective, if I can use that word, on what someone like you has experienced, how you see it. Because while there are a lot of similarities, there's some unique aspects too. So I'm curious, as you work with nonprofit leaders, and particularly leaders, let's look at maybe the individuals a little bit more than the organization. So as you work with leaders, what would you say is the biggest leadership challenge for nonprofit leaders today? What do you keep seeing over and over in what leaders are struggling with, or, finding most challenging? What do you think today is that biggest leadership challenge for nonprofit leaders?
How much time do you have?
Well, I didn't say all of them. I said the biggest one.
I'm going to give you a sort of umbrella term, and then let me break out a few really important pieces here, I think.
Okay.
I'm going to summarize this most important challenge. This is a conversation, not surprisingly, we've been having a lot, right, among colleagues, friends, partners, clients. The number one challenge for leaders right now for me is to be able, with so much going on in the world, from social justice movements to global pandemics to, managing staff that have children that may or may not be back in school, maybe in a hybrid model, whatever the case. And oh, by the way, still delivering the services, that are required of us by mission. Put all that together, and I think the real challenge for leaders right now is the ability to rise to the moment, right? To rise up and recognize, how unique this moment is because of the combination of all of these factors, and be able to rise to the moment and lead through it, not shrink, not run away from it, not turn a back to it, but rise to the moment, right? And you and I, along with a few other colleagues, put out a blog, 5 months ago now, 6 months ago, in the very early days of COVID-19, and one of the phrases that we used in that blog that still resonates deeply with me is the idea of organizations and leaders specifically being able to examine their existing portfolio. I use that word as a synonym for work plan, annual plan, strategic plan, comprehensive plan, right? But be able to examine their existing portfolio and understand the places where they should be stepping up, the places where they should be stepping in, and the places where they should be stepping back. Mm-hmm. And just quick definitions of those. I refer to step up as things we already do, but in this moment we need to do more of. We need to step up our efforts. Step in, things that maybe we weren't planning on doing, but there's a real immediate need in our organization or in our community, and we need to step in, we need to fill a gap. And step back being the things that, we had planned on doing, they seemed like a good idea when we wrote this plan a year ago or 10 months ago or whatever it was. But in the current climate, in this moment, maybe we should just step back. Maybe they aren't as much of a focus. And so rising to the moment for me continues to come to mind for leaders to be able to recognize and help their organizations and their teams recognize, where do we step up? Where do we step in? Where do we step back? Because there's an awful lot going on right now. And it's really easy, on one hand, really easy to lose focus, but on the other hand, really easy to lose relevance if you don't recognize where you need to step up and step in.
Boy, Forrest, and as you talk, I'm realizing this will come probably from my own personality and bent. And so I'm not sure if I'm on with this or if I'm off with this, but I'm thinking about, you know, Michael Jordan wanted the ball at, you know, 3 points down and 30 seconds left in the game. I want the ball. Give it to me. I know what the stakes are. I know what's got to be done. We're all pros here, but I want the ball. And sometimes that's what stepping up looks like, is let me lead the way. And what I find in coaching a lot of the leaders in the nonprofit sector, and we've already talked about some of this on this program, is a lot of nonprofit leaders consider themselves to be servant leaders, as they should, right? We're steward leaders, we're servant leaders, lots of compassion, lots of stepping back, as you say. I find the stepping up is more of a challenge in the nonprofit sector, because we need leaders who will say, I want the ball, or our organization, you know, wants the ball. I want, you know, put me in, coach. Right.
Yeah.
And me again, maybe that's just sort of my personality, but we've done some 360s on leaders that whose stakeholders come back and say, a great, wonderful, awesome leader, great vision, great with people, you know, but could use a little more like swag, you know, let's get a strut in our step and find some assertiveness, because people want to see a confident leader that has a, like, I've got a path forward. And it's not easy and it's risk involved, but I'm willing to go if you are. I mean, I get fired up when I start thinking about that kind of stuff. And when you say rise to the challenge, rise to the moment, Martin Luther King, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, George Washington, name the great leader. Right. What made them a great leader? A moment that they happened to rise to. So I'm saying all that just to say that was, I love what you just, that lit me up. If you can't tell.
Well, I have to say that my sort of leadership journey, if I think about sort of early role models, early mentors, my leadership journey started in a locker room, quite frankly, right? And learning from coaches and teammates and being a team captain and those sort of things. So occasionally I you know, get an eye roll from somebody for using too many sports analogies.
I do too.
You know, your Michael Jordan comment is a good one, right? And at the same time, right, the Bulls won some championships because Jordan made a big pass to Steve Kerr and Craig Hodges, or somebody who maybe you wouldn't think is the person who's going to take the last shot. But what separates a Jordan or a Martin Luther King or a whoever you want to list here, right, in terms of leaders you admire, it is the ability to make that distinction and make it quickly and understand when they need to make a decision as a leader, or when it's going to be a more sort of democratic, inclusive sort of process, and when we need to get the team together and think, but also when we need to act. And how do we move? And that's a real sort of separation for me. Are leaders that are able to both step up and make decisions when they need to and empower others to do the same thing, right? And two things can be true at the same time. We can be a decisive leader when we need to be, and we can believe in empowering others to be equally confident and equally able to make decisions sort of with us or on our behalf. And again, for me, that's a real separation factor. in leaders that excel and leaders that are just okay.
Really well said. And we just said it's not all about us, and it's not about being the high individual performer. So going back to Michael Jordan, that's high individual performer when it's give me the ball. Certainly, and a component of leadership in there too. But what you're describing really, I think, is more on point, which is that leadership component does mean sometimes I'm passing the ball to somebody else. I'm sure you watched The Last Dance, is it called? The documentary that was put out about the Bulls' six championships and Michael Jordan. Sure. So one of the moments in there, I don't remember exact circumstances, but was the, I think it was John Paxton three-pointer that, or was it Paxton, or there was a, or maybe it was Kukoc. I don't remember, but there was someone else who at a particular moment, they were the ones that really, we really needed to go to. And so you're right. There are those times when you've got to know when to, there's your step back or step aside, let someone else be the performer. Good stuff. What else do you think separates great leaders from everybody else? Let's just go ahead and ask the real deep,
That's right.
It's like, how do you fly an airplane?
In addition to this, the two things that I mentioned a few minutes ago, that this ability to make decisions, the ability and willingness, frankly, to empower others and lift everyone up. I think the other thing that's really important, and you mentioned this early on. I spent 2 or 3 years as the associate director, deputy director at the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy before I was elevated to the role of executive director and ultimately CEO. And so I'm using that experience to say, when I was in that number two position, my responsibility really was to execute, to understand what was happening, to build the capacity of the team, and to go out in communities and execute. When I moved into the CEO role, one of the biggest adjustments for me was how much of my time and energy I was spending trying to predict the future, right? And I think a good leader is looking out into the future and trying to predict what's coming. Now, I say that sort of on the heels of or in the midst of a global pandemic. We can't predict everything. But we can predict disruptions. We can predict ebbs and flows in funding. We can predict, partner engagement and needs in communities. And looking out into the future, I think is a real distinguishing characteristic. And we see it in organizations, right? I quite often, very early on in our engagements and conversations, will say, not tell me about what you're doing today. I can go online and read that. I can go pick up your annual report and read that. But in my very early conversations with leadership and organizations, I'll say something like, tell me what's coming. Tell me what's on the horizon. Like, look out 3 to 5 years and tell me what we need to be preparing for. And I find that the organizations that are ready to answer that question are the ones that are really ready to move and ready to go through some, I used the word transformation earlier, transformative process. But when we get in a room and ask questions like that, tell me what's coming or tell me what's out there, and people sort of look back at you with that blank stare, that's when I get a little nervous for the organization's future.
I'm thinking about our colleague and your teammate, Tom Klaus, and a comment that he made about vision when those colleagues that you talked about a minute ago were putting out some thought on leadership during the crisis. And what I called vision, Tom called sense making, and the idea that people fear the unknown. So the more the leader can make sense of the moment now, as it relates to what's coming, the clearer people feel. Even if what's coming isn't good, I'd rather know it and be able to see it and kind of know, get ready to respond to it than to just wait for it to happen. So I, give him credit for that. That's what I thought of as you were going through it. The other thing I thought of is my brother taught me to drive. And one of the early things that I was doing wrong, he figured out pretty quickly. I'm sitting at the wheel and I'm looking at the end of the hood of the car, trying to keep it between the lines. And he said, "You're looking way too close. Don't look at the hood. Look way up on the horizon. You'll see that, you'll find that keeping the car between the lines is easier if you don't look right at the lines. look at the whole picture." And that's what you're talking about, is the leader's ability to get their eyes off the hood of the car and look ahead, so that, you know, we make the curve or we make the ramp or we don't hit a deer or something. So, right. I really like that. Who were the leaders in your early career or life that have sort of shaped your view on leadership and what made them great leaders?
Oh man. You know, I said earlier when I was talking about some of the teams I've worked with, you start naming names and you get in trouble. But a few sort of points in time on my journey. I mentioned my leadership training beginning in a locker room, right? And my high school basketball coach comes to mind. And I think probably from him was the sort of demanding of excellence and recognizing what it takes to get there, right? Then you have to put in the work. And I think that's a leadership lesson I carry with me. Later on in my career, I was really, really fortunate to be surrounded by some unbelievable mentors in my early days at the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy. And part of that was, you know, in reflection, I didn't realize it at the time, but the CEO of the organization when I started there, a woman by the name of Susan Boyd, she and her husband, who is a business leader in our state, became just amazing mentors for me. And also, I benefited from the way that Susan had built the organization in those early days. And I tell this story often for different reasons, but here I'm telling it because of the fortune I had to be surrounded by mentors. We didn't have a big budget in some of those early days. And I joined the organization in 2002. We didn't have a big budget. So the organization was primarily staffed by, on one hand, grad students, and on the other hand, people who were very senior in their career and had either, you know, retired or stepped down or something recently, but were still willing to work part-time. So we had this office that was populated by, you know, young 20-something grad students like myself and a handful of others, juxtaposed with 3, 4, 5, 6 folks that were, you know, doctorally prepared or had 35 years of experience in community development, or who had been in a, you know, leadership position at the Department of Social Services or the health department. What a fascinating way to staff an organization without a huge budget. And also what a fascinating way to really pour into young professionals, right? It wasn't necessarily this deliberate, but it felt like all of us were being paired up with a senior mentor very early on in our career. And just to be able to step back and watch some of those folks and how they worked and how they had progressed in their career and what they had done, a fascinating structure, right? I mean, there's probably a white paper or a something in there for how to staff your organization with highly skilled people when you don't have a big budget. And in those early days, I mean, I'm talking about an organization that ran on a couple $100,000 budget. And by the time I left the organization in June of 2016, and this is just a point in time reference, it's nothing to do with me, the organization was $5.5-6 million and 50 staff. And 10 or 12 years earlier, we were four graduate students and four senior executives who had retired from their full-time career and wanted to work part-time. I mean, what an amazing journey. But again, I'm going on here to say that initial organizational structure was one of the most beneficial things to my career. And my guess in hindsight is SUSE knew exactly what she was doing. And it wasn't just, you know, the economics of it all. It really was putting senior level people in this office with young professionals who ultimately became the leaders of the organization. And we all grew up together. Pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is very fascinating, and it's evidence. It's a good anecdotal piece of evidence of research that's out there that says money is not a top motivator for engagement. And so what she had was this really hard to pinpoint hidden talent for casting vision in such a way that she knew how to connect people to something greater than themselves. This is my guess. She knew how to connect people. I say all the time, I wrote a blog a couple of weeks ago about it, is that leaders don't motivate, they inspire. We're already motivated. Everyone has their own individual motivations, the things that motivate us. So a leader doesn't put motive in you. A leader draws out your motivation and gets the best out of it. And she knew how to do that, is my guess, is she knew how to connect to those motivations in such a way that it wasn't about the money, it was about the fulfillment. And that just drives engagement more than anything else. So that's an extraordinary example of, yeah. I can see how that would shape your leadership bent.
I think that's right. And I'm going to tell one quick story if I can, Patrick, before we go.
That is a continuation
of that journey. You know, again, many years later in my career, I realized that folks at the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy, whether it was Susan Boyd or whether it was our board members or some of these senior folks on the team, even community partners. Again, I'm just so blessed and fortunate, the number of people that have really poured into me. And I hope that, you know, someday somebody will be having a podcast guest that says I was one that poured into them, right? You hope you pay it forward. But this journey and this evolution, I chuckle when I tell this story, especially thinking about what we know about good governance in the sector, right? But there's some leadership lessons here. In the fall of 2006, and she may get mad at me for telling this story, but I tell it in love. The fall of 2006, somewhere September, October, somewhere in there, I remember Susan Boyd, who was our director at the time, called me into her office. And she said, you know, I'm feeling like it's time for me to step aside, right? I'd still like to maybe do some consulting, right? I put that in quotes, right? Going all the way back to the earlier parts of this conversation. I'd still like to stay on with the organization, maybe do some consulting, you know, but sort of fade off a little bit, and I don't want to be the director anymore. And I'm sitting in her office, you know, fairly naively, about 28 years old at the time. And I'm nodding my head and thinking to myself, this is interesting, but why are you telling me? And she said, I just wanted you to be mentally prepared because we have a board meeting coming up next month. And I'm going to recommend to the board that you become the new director. And at the time, I didn't know any better. And so I didn't speak up and say, well, that's not exactly how this works, right? I mean, I didn't really know any different. And anyone who's listening that knows Susan Boyd, this story will not surprise them at all. It's just the way she was, right? Like, I'm stepping down and the board's going to appoint
you.
That's just the way it's going to be. That is it. So I tell that as a little sort of governance chuckle, but two very, very important sort of crucible moments almost in my leadership development that emerged from that, right? So with that backdrop I gave you, the first is I remember vividly, I can tell you even the room I was sitting in and everything, sitting across the table from our board chair at the time. Right. And now we had gone through the formality of these processes. And our board chair at the time was a woman by the name of Judy Davis. And Judy has since passed, but was just a phenomenal, dynamic leader, board chair at the United Way and campaign chairman, chairwoman at the United Way, and, you know, community volunteer extraordinaire. And we were very fortunate to have her as our board chair. And I've been very fortunate to have her as a mentor. And I remember looking across the table at Judy. And again, I was in the process of being appointed the director, being handed the keys to this organization that was on an upward trajectory in our state. And I looked across the table at Judy and I said, Judy, look, I get it, right? Susan has done an amazing job leading and growing this organization. And it's just my job to come in and make sure to not mess anything up. And again, for anyone that knows Judy, you will know exactly the look I'm talking about. But this sort of switch flipped. And she went from the happy, smiling, jovial Judy to the woman who was just such a badass leader and commander of rooms. And she looked across the table at me, Patrick, and she pointed her finger and she said, if that is your mentality, then we have hired the wrong person. And I mean, you want to talk about just sort of slumping in your chair
got
and wanting to crawl
it
out of the room. Holy smokes. I will never forget it. And I still sort of get goosebumps telling that story. And anytime I'm up for a new challenge or have a new challenge in front of me, I see Judy sitting across from me and thinking, if that's your mentality, if your mentality is just to be average, then we've selected the wrong person.
Wow.
And, talk about transformational for a young guy. And then the second part of that is a man by the name of Don Flowers. Don was a Baptist minister in Daniel Island in Charleston, South Carolina. Don was actually the founding board chairman of the South Carolina campaign back in the mid 90s. He'd been on and off the board, was back on the board. And, you know, Don was the incoming board chair, right? So Judy was the current chair. I had that conversation with her, but Don was the incoming board chair. And I'm paraphrasing this conversation a little bit, but I remember Don, you know, in context saying, agreeing to be the next board chair, but saying, you know, there's something that you and I need to talk about before that. And I said, okay. And we sat down for coffee and Don said to me, you know, someday you may go back and read board minutes or you may uncover conversations and discussions about when you became the director of this organization. So I want to be sure that you hear this from me. I again thought, okay, where's this coming? And he said, your selection as our next director was not unanimous. He said, and I was the dissenting voice.
Oh, wow.
He said, but I want to tell you why. He said, I was trying to protect you. He said, and I don't have any doubt that you would have, you know, defeated, that's not the word he used, but defeated any challengers, right? That you would have interviewed well, that you would have won this position. I just thought that as a mechanism of protecting you as a young professional, so there was no doubt in anyone's mind that you were the right person. And so that there was no doubt in anyone's mind that you had just been handed this thing or that you didn't deserve it.
Mm.
He said, those are the reasons that I was a dissenting voice. And he said, I will be your board chair and I will be your biggest supporter. And 14 years later, Don is still my biggest supporter. Heather and I flew Don to New York to officiate our wedding. He's a dear friend. He's a mentor. And all of that goes back to this conversation in a coffee shop when he said, by the way, if you ever read the minutes, I was a dissenting vote on you becoming the next director of this organization. I mean, just the sort of transparency, the courage, the value system that one has to have to sit down and be that open about that, and also then tell you why they did it and help you learn from it and get better from it. I couldn't leave your question, like, who are the people that have taught you about leadership along the way, without telling that story about Judy and Don. And by the way, those two things happened back to back, right? Like within a month of each other. But really, really important moments for me as I became the director of the campaign. But even 20 years later, I remember both of those stories like they were yesterday.
Clearly, you tell them like they were yesterday. You can still, I can feel that you can feel them. What great stories, particularly Judy's, you made me think of the parable of the talents. You know, in the Bible, the owner of an estate gives a certain number of talents to several stewards and says, I'm leaving. And when I come back, you know, you can tell me what you did with them. And the steward that buried the talents in order to protect them and make sure that they were still there when the owner got back, came back, handed the talents to the owner and said, here, I protected these for you. And he was rebuked because the other stewards took the talents, invested them, and grew them. Mm. And so as stewards, our job is not just to protect and maintain status quo. And as you said, not mess something up. Our job is to grow it to the next level. And that's what Judy was giving you is no, this isn't about protection and maintaining. This is about next level stuff. What a great story. Forrest, you know, I can't imagine not bringing you back on the program at some time, because this is a show about leadership, and I don't know anybody that can talk about it any better than you can. And with your experiences, I do want to thank you for not just coming on the program, but you reached out recently and took ownership of creating a friendship and a relationship with me. And I know you do that with others, but drawing me in, and I'm loving it, because I think we're learning from each other. I think we're continuing to think about ways that we can work together. And this is one way of doing it. So thanks for that. And all the best to you in Memphis. I know that 1000 Feathers continues to thrive and help organizations. And I know Heather's just going to be amazing. Make sure you tell her I'm going to want her on this program soon. And we'll have you back. I'm going to put links, or at least a link to 1000 Feathers in the show notes here in the episode, on the episode page. So make sure you check it out. And if you're a nonprofit in Memphis or South Carolina or Alaska or Hong Kong, Forrest and I, we know his team. I mean, we just know this is first class stuff, so you can't go wrong. And thanks again, Forrest. I really appreciate it. Anything else you want to say in closing?
No, Patrick, I just really appreciate you. I appreciate the invitation, and the feeling is mutual. We are better because of each other, and the more that relationship grows, the more excited I am about it. So
yeah,
thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
Very cool. Thank you. That's it for this week, folks. That's the Jinx perspective and the Forrest Alton perspective. In a couple of days, we've got Nick Nanton as our guest. Nick is a 15-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. He's an attorney. He's a musician and songwriter with some national music awards. He is a brand specialist and branding agency, DNA, Dix Nanton Agency, and the Celebrity Branding Agency. I could go on and on, but just, you don't want to miss this. Tune in a couple of days for Nick Nanton. That's it for today. Lead on, folks.